This is Metal Mike.
This is Mojo Mumi from KSYFM.com and DailyBoomRadio.com.
And we are your co-hosts for an awesome conversation with the very talented Todd Kearns. We talk bands and projects that Todd's involved with, like Slash, Took, and the Bruce Kulick Band, who his early influences are, and we end it all with a righteous Kiss roundtable. We contemplate what if Ace was invited back to Kiss in 1987. Stay tuned for after the episode where I do my first Axe and You Shall Receive. We've got a listener that writes in with a question comment about QR3 by Quiet Riot. Check this thing out.
Well, Todd, welcome to the 80s Glam Metal Cast, and also let me welcome Mojo Mumi, a special co-guest with me here. Co-host, let's get it right. How's it going, gentlemen?
Great, how are you?
Man, awesome. Excellent. This is great with you guys here. So, Todd, we got some questions for you, man. You ready to answer some questions?
Hit me.
All right.
Hit me with it.
Well, hey, man, let's break the ice. What have you been up to during your downtime with all this COVID stuff going on?
You know, at first it started off, you know, I don't know, it was like acclimating to a different gravity, you know, where we weren't touring or doing shows. And then I sort of went into this mode of liking it more than I should because mm-hmm. I don't take time off. I just did the math. The last time I was on stage was March 14th. So that's over 5 months off or coming up on. Yeah, it's something like that. So I just said to my wife, I said, you realize it's September 14th, that's 6 months of no shows? I go, that's really bizarre.
Wow.
And I think that's pretty universal because the next day, around the 14th or something like that, was when they shut the world down. So, but I have been, you know, went into a mode of writing and recording with multiple projects that has sort of kept me really busy and really satisfied, I suppose. It sort of scratches that itch that's totally like is very apparent by not being on stage night after night after night or as often as possible. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
What kind of projects are you working on? Like what kind of stuff are you working on? Like a solo album? What kind of material?
I've always been chipping away at a solo album. I don't know if back in 2013 I made a solo album that was predominantly acoustic music, which was completely like aside from everything else that I do because I actually love grabbing an acoustic guitar and just randomly showing up at places and you know, making a bunch of racket for hours on end. So that turned into a record, and I love it so much that I wanted to do it again. So I've been chipping away at that. In the meantime, one of my side bands, Took, which is a Canadian, it started as a Canadian tribute band, which is the weirdest thing. It's myself and Brent Fitz from Slash's band, who also plays with me in Bruce Kulick's band. We're both Canadian, and we grew up on a lot of crazy regional Canadian music. And we started doing charity shows in Canada, and we had decided to just do all Canadian rock from, like, Loverboy and April Wine and Rush. You know, it was a long list of stuff that started off. We released two albums worth of just like tribute music, like an homage to some of our favorite songs. And on the second album, we ended up writing one song. And now we just wrote, I think, our fifth song yesterday. So it's been a slow, well, not that slow. I mean, because we've actually like been tracking as we go along. Some of it remotely, some of it together, depending on who's around and who's away. And then Slash and I have been getting together. And then Bruce Kulick and I have been knocking heads. So it's a number of different projects that, you know, for me, it's been really, really healthy to be, you know, having to be creative and having to get, and really testing my own home studio skills too, which, to be honest, are super lacking because there's unusually, I usually hand it over to a grown up who knows what the hell he's doing. So, but I, you know, I really do enjoy that side of things. So it's been a lot of fun. I also did a side project that one of the first things that's coming out is this side project with myself, Jeremy Asbrock, and Matt Starr from Ace Frehley's band. Mm-hmm. We do a side project with this young guy named Brandon Fields, who kind of came out of nowhere and sort of said to us, what do you guys think about doing this project? And Jeremy was, you know, vouched for him. And I thought, hey, I'm sitting at home. I'm really enjoying this kind of like recording at home thing. And we just started knocking ideas around. The next thing I knew, we had a full album worth of material. And then it's Brandon's project. It's called Minefield. And he went out and got a deal with Golden Robot Records. And it's, I think the first single drops mid to late September. So it's pretty fascinating how, you know, a big door closes, but the windows always seem to be open. You know, I mean, there's always something else to kind of dig into.
That's super cool. And starting from the beginning, Todd, who was influential on you picking up the bass or even singing?
Well, Kiss is always first and foremost. I think the Beatles obviously goes in there. As a little kid, my parents had records like the Beatles and Elvis and that kind of stuff. And it sort of became, you know, the four major food groups of rock and roll, Buddy Holly and stuff like that. And but I always say, though, when I was a kid, it was weird. I had this weird thing where I looked at the Beatles and I looked at Kiss, and it really didn't feel like anything a normal mortal person could do. Do you know what I mean? Like, the Beatles felt like they came from Valhalla, and Elvis came from another planet. Mm-hmm. And then Kiss were actual superheroes, you know, breathing fire and drooling blood and flying. And, you know, it didn't really connect with me that we could actually do what they're doing until later on. It wasn't until, like, bands like The Who, which led to a lot of punk rock, where picking up a guitar made me kind of think, hey, I think I could do this, you know? And then I realized once you picked up the guitar, you look back on the things that, like the Beatles and the Stones and the, and all those things that, and Kiss especially, that I thought, you know, were things I couldn't do, that you started to kind of find yourself going like, oh, okay, I could do this. And that's sort of where, for me, in a lot of ways, it sort of starts with these really big inspirations, but inspirations in that I love the music, but actually picking up the guitar was a little later on by bands like, seeing like, more like, you know, punk rock bands actually made me think, like, I could do that, I think.
Oh, wow.
I already know we're all Kiss fans, all right, so let's just put that out there. But I think, you know, Mojo and I are pretty fascinated by the whole Bruce Kulick band thing. How did this pairing come together?
Well, that's actually really interesting, because I've known Brent Fitz, the drummer in Slash's band. He played in Union with Bruce, post-Kiss for Bruce. But I've known Brent for probably 30 years in some fashion or another. And he's always been really good to me and a big champion of, like, get Todd to do this, get Todd to do that. And then BK3, Bruce was getting ready to put out the third album, his third solo album. And we got together. We actually did an episode. I was just talking about this a minute ago. We did an episode of Gene Simmons' Family Jewels when we did a CD release party at the Cat Club on Sunset Strip in Hollywood. And Nick got up. Nick Simmons got up and sang the song he sings on the record. Most of the Kiss guys were there hiding up in the dressing room. And it was a big night. And about a week or two later, we were both playing in Slash's band. It just sort of, you know, spiraled, as those Hollywood things do, into us playing a Slash. But that was in 2010. We did that CD release party. And then, you know, years go by, and the Kulick Brothers was the initial approach about these Kiss crews. Kiss Crew 7, I guess it was, Bob and Bruce, and we put together stuff from Bruce's era, stuff from Bob's era. I played bass in that show, and then, and then we did the next couple. We brought in Zach Throne from Corey Taylor from Slipknot's band. And he plays bass in that. That's the funny thing about Zach and I, we both play bass or we both play guitar depending on the gig we're doing. Zach's actually an amazing guitar player. If you see the new Corey Taylor single that's out, that's him playing solo in the video.
In Black Eyed Blue?
Black Eyed Blue, yeah. And he plays bass and sings all the Gene stuff, and I play rhythm guitar and sing all the Paul stuff with Bruce. So it's, Zach's one of those guys I've known since 92 in one fashion or another. We just kind of met in 92 and lost track of each other, but we've kind of always crossed paths. But yeah, so it's a really weird how, I guess the Kiss Cruise is actually the instrumental thing that keeps bringing it back together, because it sort of was like a Bob and Bruce thing. It's going to be fun, one-off thing, and that spun into the Bruce Kulick thing, and that's happened several times since.
How cool is Bruce Kulick? The guy is a super down-to-earth guy. I met him man, probably 3 or 4 years ago, and he was with Grand Funk Railroad. They played here, and got the chance to meet him, and just one of the most coolest guys you could ever meet.
Dude, I it's so funny because the very first time I saw Kiss was in 1985, March something, 1985. I know the date, but it's escaping me at the moment. On the Animalize tour. So,
wow.
This girl I know was at the same concert a long time ago, and she sent me photos of just like the show, the very show. And there's a picture of like the band on stage, and you can see the audience in the pit. And I send it to Bruce. I go, this is our first picture together. I'm somewhere in that giant pit of people at like 14 years old or something. So it's a big deal to me because Kiss was a massive deal to me. And I was that kid at school who was still buying Kiss records when it was kind of like my, you know, other guys weren't buying them as much anymore. You know what I mean? So I knew exactly who was in the band. So when, like, you know, Vinny was there, and then Mark was there, and then Bruce was there, there was a whole period where there was a lot of confusion on the Mark and Bruce, you know, because Bruce essentially was filling in for Mark at first. But when they came to town, I knew who Bruce Kulick was. I think I'd probably even done, you know, pre-internet sort of search about, like, Bruce Kulick from Piper and, you know, with Michael Bolton, and he's played with this, and played Meatloaf, you know. And so all these years later, to kind of find myself standing in a hockey arena watching him play to suddenly being on stage together, whether it's the Cat Club or a Kiss Cruise, that kind of stuff's never lost on me because I'm a big rock and roll fan. Enthusiast, I think, is the word. Fan makes it sound a little bit scary or something. Yeah, like I might hurt somebody. But yeah, no, it's a big deal. And he's an amazing guy, and he has relocated to Las Vegas. So I'm in Vegas, Fitz is in Vegas, Zach's in Vegas, we're all in Vegas, this band's all in Vegas, so we sort of split our time between here and Los Angeles, but yeah, we're all around, so it's just kind of turned out, it's really unfortunate that the COVID thing happened, because we were kind of really getting going on getting some ideas together, and then, you know, the COVID thing screwed a lot of things up. I mean, not just jamming with Bruce, but it screwed things up with you know, with everything else in the whole wide world. So, but it would have been really nice to have gotten a real leg up on some recording between the four of us. Plus, it really screwed up the upcoming Kiss Cruise, which was sort of the next thing we were going to do, which is coming up. Well, would have been coming up around Halloween, but it's not happening this year, as you know.
Damn.
Yeah.
Todd, you're touching on something that I was thinking about was how do you, this is probably no easy task, but how do you go into writing for something like this? Because there's a lot of expectations, right? Like it's got to kind of sound like Kiss, but then it can't, it really shouldn't sound like, I mean, there's got to be some conflict on how you approach writing for something like this. What's the thought process?
That's actually a really good question. It would be really weird if we made a reggae album. Which...
Well, yeah, every little really thing good, gonna be all right.
Yeah.
Well,
predominantly,
well,
yeah, dubstep and reggae.
Kiss did a disco album, so you can...
That is true, although, you know, I still argue it's a great album. I really love that
it
album.
Is. It is.
Love it.
But, you know, honestly, it sort of comes from the top down, and I sort of don't make him, but I sort of think that there has to be, Bruce has to lead that fight, you know what I mean? He has mm-hmm. to do, the riffs and everything have to come from him, and we'll build songs around that. And because of, you know, his signature is so huge on records like, well, actually on all of those records, his imprint is larger than we even know, but especially on things like Carnival and Revenge, when Bruce, you know, became when it became a really hard rock band, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Obviously, things like Hot in the Shade and Asylum and Crazy Nights, all those records are essentially hard rock records, but they kind of let go of the radio rock chains and went full on hard rock band, you know what I mean? So by Revenge, it was like, it was a return to this heavier rock band that we all kind of grew up on. So that's kind of the realm we try to live in. You know what I mean? Like, I think as far as like trying to come up with original ideas, I feel like they should be somewhere in that area. Mm-hmm. We're all big fans of the entire catalog. I mean, we're all very well invested. Brent Fitz played in Gene Simmons' solo band this last time around. And, you know, so we're really well invested in, you know, all the original records and all the records that followed. So, but I think that, you know, because Bruce is the guitar player, to me it's kind of like, well, he should dictate how it should sound and where we should go. So it's kind of like,
right,
it should be a big rock record as far as I'm concerned. And that's kind of where I'm directing it.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah.
The awkward silence. Mojo, go ahead. Yeah. I'll cut all these go aheads out. I swear.
Have you ever forgot, for whatever reason, the words to a song while you're on stage, or a bass line in a song while you're playing live? I mean, I was a lead singer in a band years ago and constantly forgot words, the songs I wrote.
Oh, dude, I don't know what it is. Like, I can sing, like, I don't know, Cold Gin right now, you know, without provocation, just sing it top to bottom, no problem. But there are songs that I wrote that I'll be on stage in front of a full crowd going like, oh, dude, what? I'll be singing the second verse first or something weird like that. And be like, it's a classic thing of like, but I think it's really good to do that, because I think it shows the world that this isn't on tape. This is happening right now. You know, yes. I think in a lot of ways in the modern world, everybody's got a teleprompter these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're at, I don't know, Aerosmith or Rod Stewart or whatever, like all those big name dudes all have a teleprompter or teleprompters scattered about the stage. I don't think that they necessarily stand there and stare at them. Like Ozzy Osbourne is staring at the teleprompter. It's just sort of like if you're starting to get kind of like, you know, coming out of the guitar solo, and it's kind of like, oh, what's the next verse? And you look down and go, oh, there it is. Boom. Billions of people or whatever, you know. And I think that that's very helpful. But I haven't never had that that luxury. It would be nice, but at the same time, it's kind of like, what are you going to do? You know,
right.
Especially when you wrote the goddamn song. I mean,
Oh, my God. Yeah,
I've seen enough, like, you know, big name groups. And one of the things that I always point out is that on the Animalize live concert in Detroit, Paul Stanley sings the fourth verse twice. Like, there are four verses in that song, and you can go and check it now, but I think he sings 12 o'clock, you gotta rock twice, instead of like, you know, whatever. Getting late, I just can't wait. Whatever that verse is, I'm quite sure. So I never thought about it until about the 900th time I'd watched that concert and thought, like, hey, wait a second, who sings that same verse twice? And that's just the nature of, you know, yeah, you can check it out. If you play enough shows in your life, all the Spinal Tap things come true. You know what I mean? You're going to break strings, your amp's going to go down. You're going to trip and fall. And I've done all that stuff. I split my pants, you know, far more embarrassing things than just forgetting the words, you know. So, you know, and I think the best part of the trick is just kind of getting comfortable on stage in front of an audience and being able to roll with the changes that are happening. Because sometimes you're singing, you're doing whatever, and you look over and go, do I know that dude? He looks familiar. And then you go to sing the thing, and you're completely not in the game anymore. And you're like, oh, damn, what's the next verse? But
That same thing happened to me in Des Moines years ago. We would always do a Metallica medley, and we'd start it off with their version of Am I Evil? And then go into Seek and Destroy. And then right before the guitar solo, we'd bust into For Whom the Bell Tolls. And there was a guy that was up front, and right before I came in with the first verse. This guy starts screaming the second verse, totally screwed up the whole song for me.
I sang
that whole second verse and tried to go back to the first verse. No, it didn't happen at all. So,
no, it's weird. It's weird the things that can derail a song. You know, there's been a couple times on stage where, you know, someone has the wrong tuned guitar, you know, you're using certain different tunings on songs, and someone picks up the wrong guitar and starts the song, and it's a total train wreck. But that's, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's bound to happen that, if you do enough shows, if you do 100 shows, at least one of them is going to have some problems. Good chance all of them are going to have some kind of problem. Guitar string broken, amp went down, whatever, all that kind of stuff. That's bound to happen. That's part of the charm of doing a live rock and roll show. Unless you're lucky enough to be able to do it like a theater performance where it's exactly the same thing every single night. But even then, they have things that go wrong and things that act up. It's just the way it goes, yeah.
Right.
Well, speaking of having to learn like a lot of lyrics and a lot of songs, what was it like learning the songs for the Bruce Kulick band? Because obviously you're a Kiss fan, you know these songs, but I mean, at this point, you've got to know the lyrics verbatim, you got to know the riffs. Was it challenging? Was it easy? How did it go?
Well, it's challenging too because we worked a lot of the songs into medleys because there was so much material we wanted to tackle, but it was sort of like, when you really actually did the math, we were doing like something like 35 to 40 songs in a set or something ridiculous like that. And that would have been like a 4-hour show or something. So we started to kind of cut it down. A lot of it was easy for us to learn because we're all such fans. But at the same time, learning a medley is a different thing. You got to learn how it flows and we go to this, we go to that. At the same time, you kind of forget how challenging 80s and 90s Kiss is because Paul's at the peak of his ability singing, I'd Fight Hell to Hold You, the vocal's so high, it's bananas, but it was really fun and it was really, really exciting to be able to do that because it was such a, like I say, it was such a tribute and an homage to these songs that we loved and we grew up on. Made sense to me.
Yeah, it's funny. Before we called you, obviously we're planning this out. We're talking a little bit. But we got chatting about a lot of stuff. And one thing that we both were talking about is that, it's nice to hear some of these 80s songs live again because you haven't heard them either ever or you haven't heard them in, 20, 30 years. And, I know, Paul Stanley's voice, he still has a voice, but I don't think he really has the voice to do that 80s stuff anymore, And one thing that I kind of envisioned, I don't know if it would ever happen, but maybe when the dust settles with Kiss, I mean, I'd love to see somebody like Paul go on a storyteller's type of a tour, and bring somebody like you. And, he can still tell the stories behind the songs. He's still a great showman. He's a great player. Just because he can't hit those super high notes anymore, I still think the songs have great value. They sound great live. It's nice to hear them modernized in a modern setting. So, I mean, I think people would be interested in something like that.
Well, it's funny that you say that because like I said, as a fan who grew up with the band from the very early days all the way through, it's been interesting to me to learn how many people found Kiss post-makeup. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there was a lot of, kids who thought of Kiss with no makeup as just another hard rock band of all the hard rock bands that were around. Cinderella, take your pick of all the rock bands that were around, and Kiss was just this another, not just another band, but they were, for all intents and purposes, on the Headbangers Ball, they were another long-haired rock and roll band. Mm-hmm. So I think that they, I'm always kind of taken aback by how many people are lift it up forward. It's sort of their era. Mm-hmm. And we've really learned that when we started doing this Bruce Kulick, stuff, because it was like, there's a part of you that kind of goes, look, I'm an invested fan. I love this stuff. And when we're doing No, or take your pick, I mean, Hell or High Water, or any of these songs, I'm thinking, yeah, well, I love these songs, but I know that Kiss themselves don't play these songs because a giant populace wants to hear God of Thunder and Shout Out Loud and Rock and Roll All Night and Detroit Rock City. So they don't really kind of delve into that sort of distant past. And when we do it, people go crazy. Like I said, people are like grown men in tears. It's amazing to see because people think, first of all, they've never seen this song played live because A, it probably wasn't played live, or B, they haven't heard it played live in a long time. So we did a lot of stuff that has never been, we've done a lot of stuff that's never been performed live, including the Carnival of Souls stuff, because they would never even have the opportunity to perform live by Kiss.
Right.
And then he goes all the way down the line. Like, there's a lot of songs from all those records that just, they didn't get performed live because how gigantic the Kiss catalog is. Like, even stuff like King of the Mountain or I've Had Enough or any of those songs from the Animalize Asylum kind of era, some of the songs got performed once or twice, but then didn't pop up again. And then the tours, you know, just wrapped up.
Under the Gun was another one.
Under the Gun, they definitely played that for a while. I remember hearing it on, like, Animalize, and but they probably cut it loose by Asylum or Crazy Nights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and once again, hey, it's time to brown nose, man. You do a killer job. I mean, you do the songs justice. And you know, I wanted to say earlier, I should have added this in, but I went back and I listened to some of your cover albums, and freaking Eldo Nova, man, it was like spot on. You sounded exactly like him, but it, I mean, it was just sounded like a current version of that song. That was so killer. But even with the Kiss stuff, like you have your own voice, but you can really capture the spirit of the songs that you cover. So great job, man. Great job.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, like you say, it's like we're not trying to do an impersonation, really. It's sort of like it really is like it's 2020, and we're trying to play the Kiss songs how we play them. And you kind of have to do them justice. We're pretty religious about making sure that they're played correctly and we're not, you know, selling them short at all, because that would be unforgivable in my opinion. So that means you got to go, okay, this song is really crazy high, so here we go. I got to stick it as high as I can. That's all you can do.
Well, guys, I think we've reached the point where we're going to have our Kiss roundtable discussion. And strangely enough, you know, the topic of discussion mostly was Bruce Kulick tonight, but we're going to throw a curveball here. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about what if Ace was allowed back in Kiss around 1987 through 1989. So basically your thought process here is you want to picture like Frehley's Comet morphing with the Crazy Nights album and, you know, maybe the Second Sighting and the other albums he's done mixing with Hot in the Shade. So Mojo, why don't you start us off? Do you think this would work? What kind of band would Kiss be with Ace in the 80s? Would they be as heavy? What are your thoughts on something like this?
Yeah, Ace was back in the band around 87. I can see it being almost like it was with Bruce. I don't know. I think it'd have a little bit more edge to it than the polished synthesizer the sound that you got out of it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It'd definitely be different. Obviously, their styles of playing are different. So, I still think it'd be good. But
I was going to say too, because I think that Bruce was sort of brought in just as Mark was brought in, at a time when everybody was looking for an Eddie Van Halen or a Randy Rhoads or a George Lynch or a shredder 80s guitar player. And Ace sort of was more from that school of Jimmy Page and, well, essentially Ace Frehley. No one else plays like Ace Frehley because he's Ace Frehley. And he's one of my all-time favorite guitar players ever. But it's certainly, when you try to think about that in context, because obviously those... Frehley's Comet, Second Sighting, those records, Ace still plays like Ace does. But he did sound, in his own way, a lot more like Ace, like classic Ace sounding, than probably Kiss sounded like classic Kiss in a way. Like, mm-hmm. I think the evolving of things into, like you're saying about Ron Nevison's production on Crazy Nights, is essentially very slick and a very on purpose, you know, intentional move to try and, I would assume, intentional to try and get on mainstream radio and
very, very Bon Jovi-ish.
Yeah, and bands like Ron Nevison had done Heart, that massive era of Heart that they had done, and Ozzy's Shot in the Dark or Killer of Giants or whatever the hell that album was called.
Ultimate Sin.
Ultimate Sin, thank you. So very slick, big, you know, sounding recordings. And Ace sort of, you know, kind of hung out in his Ace Frehley rock and roll, very New York sounding kind of thing. So I think it's possible to imagine it together, but it would be markedly different because of, like, trying to imagine Second Sighting songs on Crazy Nights is like, it would be rad, because as a Kiss fan, we would all have been going like, it's always awesome to hear that Ace song on a Kiss record, no matter which record you're listening to. It's like during, say, Unmasked. You know, it's kind of like, some of that was another attempt to be a lot sort of poppier sounding, I suppose. But Ace Frehley's songs always sounded kind of like Ace Frehley's songs to me in a way. You know what I mean? Like, Talk to Me and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Even though it's slightly poppier for Ace, it still kind of sounded like Ace, you know, throwing down a straight-up three-chord rock and roll song. It's hard to imagine them taking Bruce Kulick out now because of his stamp on those records. That's mm-hmm. far from me.
Well, here, let me throw this at you guys. This is where some of my thoughts were coming from. So, of course, we know that, like you said, Kiss was looking for shredders in the 80s and, you know, Eddie Van Halen type stuff. But let's think of some of the other guys that were out in the 80s. I mean, Angus Young was still rocking out pretty hard in the 80s. AC/DC was still at Headbangers Ball. Even Jimmy Page mm-hmm. kind of was out there doing Outrider. Remember when he did his solo album? So, yeah. And I think that's the way Ace comes across. Like we said, you know, he's not a shredder. He's not one of those guys. Another thing to think about is if you look at Crazy Nights, it's not one of my favorite albums, I'm going to be honest with you. And I would love to see some of those songs extracted and put in like Into the Night or Rock Soldiers on there. I think that would add to the album, and I think overall would add to the popularity of the band. I think the band would be looked at back again. Once again, no respect. I love Bruce Kulick, and I love his, like you said, his stamp on those albums, but I think from a marketing standpoint, from all that kind of stuff. So those are some of my thoughts. I that's the way I'm envisioning it. You know, we're bringing
back. That's actually really interesting. When you put it that way, it's actually really interesting. And I think in a lot of ways, it'd be really interesting to hear a record like Crazy Nights remixed with perhaps less keyboard and, you know, just a lot more kind of a straight up rock and roll record. Then I think you might be onto something. But I mean, obviously, if Ace was still in the band, I think he was, I think Ace was still playing ball at that stage of his career, too. I think everybody wanted to kind of get on the radio, and I think everybody wanted to try and, AC/DC is a very interesting parallel because AC/DC never seemed to ever play ball. You know, AC/DC always said, we're AC/DC, and we're going to be AC/DC. So they made every record just how they wanted to make that record. Not to say that Kiss was sort of like bending in any way, but I think that they, you know, they definitely, you know, like that whole 80s period for all rock bands, because there was a time where, say, AC/DC or and later on, like the new wave of heavy metal, you know, like Priest and Maiden and bands like that, I don't think they ever really ever considered being on the radio, you know what I mean? So I don't think that any of those bands really played ball until hard rock became what it became in the 80s, which became a viable, sellable thing. You know what I mean? Like, no one foresaw, you know,
Turbo Lovers.
Yeah, well, that's true too, yeah. But I think even Turbo Lover is an attempt to try and cash in on,
yeah,
probably a Bon Jovi and Cinderella mm-hmm. and Poison or whatever mainstream acts were really blowing up on rock radio that were quote unquote heavy metal bands. You know what I mean? Or what they now refer to as hair metal, which I always kind of think is a bit silly because, well, everybody had hair.
Everybody's got it.
Yeah. All bands had long hair back then. That's kind of the way it was. But, it would be really interesting. And I think you're probably absolutely correct because what Ace would have brought to the table would have been what Ace brings to the table. And they would have just, okay, well, then we're going to do Crazy Nights and, Hell or High Water, and then the next song is Rock Soldiers, and then, you know, like Paul song, Gene song, Ace song, and that's kind of the way it would have went.
You know, you wonder, too, was the band, how do I want to put this, would he have been allowed to be open to do things? Because if you look at, you know, if you look at Crazy Nights, every single is Paul Stanley. Also could be that Gene didn't have the strongest material at that point. I mean, would Ace have a single in a 80s Kiss? That's another question.
Well, that's very interesting to consider, isn't it? Because I don't know if that was a conscious effort in a lot of ways, because I still feel like Gene was, I mean, I like a lot of Gene's material from that era as well, but mm-hmm. it almost felt like they kind of, maybe it became sort of like important to have a focal point.
Yeah.
Or maybe Paul Stanley looked good in terms of like the other front men of rock bands at that time. Paul kind of carried a certain amount of, well, I mean, he was sort of the, you know, in a lot of ways, the forerunner of all that in a lot of ways, but he did, you know, good looking dude in great shape, singing his ass off. It makes sense that he was up front. But you're right. I don't know. But again, you know, Ace Frehley, you know, Ace's songs to me were always kind of like integral parts of all the records, whether they were like, I don't know if Shock Me is necessarily what you'd consider the hit single off of Love Gun, but it was definitely important to me.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's always interesting to kind of play those what ifs. Obviously, you know, there's no going back in time, but sometimes you do. You look at those things and it's like, okay, you know, Ace is doing an album, Kiss is doing an album. Could those albums have morphed together and what would it have looked like? So, like I said, it's fun to think about, you know?
That'd be a lot of fun to actually. Now you've got me thinking, I'm going to go listen to all those records back to back and imagine them, how they would work together.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be really fun.
Well, hey, real quick, pick the song that, tell me, I want to know from you guys, what Crazy Nights song would you eliminate? I'd love to hear it.
Oh, boy.
Oh, wow.
That's a tough one.
Good Girl Gone Bad.
Interesting.
Hmm. Not that I hate it, because there's not too many Kiss songs that I don't like. Hey, yeah, if I'm listening to a bunch of Kiss songs or pulling out records or pulling out CDs or something, there might be one song that, yeah, maybe I'll skip that one for now because I've heard it a million times. Like, I don't know,
right.
Rock and Roll Night or Hard Luck Woman or
Yep.
Beth. But I think if I were to skip a song on Crazy Nights, it'd probably be Good Girl Gone Bad.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
What do you think?
Oh man, that's really tough. That's really tough for me. Bang Bang You, maybe? I'm just going to go off the top of my head. It's really hard for me to think. I'm in sort of the same boat as Mojo, where it's kind of like, well, there's, you know, I've listened to the albums a gazillion times, and, you know, it's more a case of like, oh, I've heard that one a million times. It doesn't mean that in a couple of years from now, I might actually actively seek out that particular song. It just means that I've heard the album so many times that you kind of don't need to hear that one or whatever. But, you know, I'm sort of that way with a lot of the more mainstream Kiss songs anyway, cause as I am with a lot of the same mainstream Led Zeppelin songs. You know, I don't need to hear Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin again in my life, but
mm-mm.
Whenever it comes on the radio, I still go like, this sounds great. You know what I mean? Like, but you know, Rock and Roll All Night is one of those songs that where we as fans kind of go, yeah, I mean, it's a given that you have to hear the song, but I don't know if we actively seek it out to listen to it.
No.
But we all love that song because it's a great song.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm with you on Bang Bang You. That would be gone. And I'm not a big fan of No, No, No. I don't know. It just doesn't do anything for me.
It was a fun one to play.
Oh, I'm sure.
It has that whole intro with the guitar solo.
I always love to hear Eric Carr.
Me too.
His background vocals in that song.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. You know, and that's
an underutilized voice.
Yeah, and that's one thing we didn't really ever mention, because let's face it, we never got a lot of good output from Eric Carr together with Ace Frehley, right? Because, you know, they really, would we get the Elder? And then that was it. So, I mean, to have those guys back together in, you know, as a cohesive unit, that would have been cool, guys. That would have been cool.
That's what's fun about doing with the Bruce Band. We do Little Caesar in our show. And the Eric song is like, you know, no one ever thought they would ever hear that song live. Nope. Why would they?
Yeah.
You know, it's like Eric's no longer with us. And I'm like, I was pretty adamant about it. I go, if we're going to do this, we have to do that, because it's, you know, it's like that. I always loved that song. And I always thought, you know, Eric would sing Young and Wasted or Black Diamond. He kicked ass. Like, he was just awesome on it. And I was like, we need to do these songs, you know?
Little Caesar is such a great song on that album.
It really is, yeah. In fact, I think it's a standout as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the better songs on that album.
I agree. Absolutely.
Are you guys familiar with the song Eyes of Love on Eric Carr's Rockology?
I remember that. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I remember the title, yeah.
Yeah, go back and check that one out. I really like that song by him, and that's another head-scratcher for me. Like, when I hear that song, I'm like, how did that not make it on a Kiss album? Because for me, it smokes a lot of the Gene and Paul songs, especially on Hot in the Shade. I would have gave Eric, if Eric Carr could have had two, he could have had Little Caesar and Eyes of Love. Go back and check that one out. I mean, I think that's a really killer song.
I will. I'll do that. I'm getting in the car in a minute. I'm going to crank that one up.
Beautiful. Well, hey, guys, I appreciate having both of you on tonight. Why doesn't everybody give a shameless plug to their show, radio show, podcast? Go right around the horn, guys.
Go for it, Mojo.
Give us a plug. Give your show a plug.
It's Mojo Mumi from Mojo Rocks on KSOIFM.com and DailyBoomRadio.com.
Nice. Ty.
Nice.
And I'm Todd Kearns. I'm Todd Kearns on all social media except for Twitter. I am Todd Dannett Kearns with my offensive middle name. And then I have a Tuke. The band Tuke has a chat show on Tuesdays, Tuke Tuesdays at 2, talking to a lot of awesome old school Canadian rockers. This upcoming Tuesday, well, we just did Helix and then the Killers Wharf. So we've had a lot of amazing fun. Every Tuesday we do that on Facebook Live. And then I do my own talk show on Thursdays, Todd Dannett Kearns Talks To. And I've talked to like all my friends from Ace Frehley's band and just basically anybody who will talk to me, basically, I try and talk to. So you can find me on there as well.
Awesome, guys. I'll put the links down in the video's description. Love talking with you both. Have a great night.
You as well, man. Take care.
Bye, guys.
It's time for Ask and You Shall Receive.
Okay, so we put it out there on Twitter. We wanted your questions, your comments, your thoughts, and now we're going to start airing them on the 80s Glam Metalcast. First in comes from Smike T. Okay, and this is what Smike says. Always loved the first two Quiet Riot albums and really had high hopes for QR3. They went glam, they didn't have to, and the rest is history. What could have been if this was a solid third hard rock album? Well, here's my thoughts. In 1986, I think a glam image, not talking about sound, but an image for Quiet Riot was absolutely necessary. We got to think back to the balding Kevin DeBrow. He's got the striped suits and the stars. I don't think he would have fit in for the look of 1986. I don't really know if they had a chance. Were people sick of them? They did back-to-back albums one year right after another. And I think Condition Critical was basically a misstep. It was kind of an uninspired album that was very similar to the one before it. Just trying to cash in on the success. So, you know, some metal bands that started off early in the decade, like Quiet Riot and Twisted Sister, they really started to fall short in the later half of the decade. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if some bands, fame and success, just, you know, can't handle it. I don't know. Let's also point out that DeBrow was very cocky at this point. And I think his attitude that he was putting out there kind of hurt the band. QR3 does have some tunes that I actually like. I think the first three are the best. I love Wild and the Young, and I went back and I watched the videos, and I think they're good singles, they're good videos. The rest of the songs, I gotta admit, I feel are kind of like throwaways. They're not that great, and I think even looking back at those videos and those singles, and even some of the other songs, there's just way too much synth. Every song has like a little element of synth in it, and I don't think that really went over that great. I don't think it had to be like Metal Health, whatever they were going to do, but it needed to be good, right? Probably needed to follow a Motley Crue type formula. That's what a lot of bands were doing, and it was working at that point, but I don't really know. Maybe if these songs had a little bit more of an edge, were a little bit heavier, maybe they would have been a little bit more successful. It's a shame because, you know, these guys, you know, rest in peace, Frankie and Kevin, are talented. We're a very talented band. Should have went on to super, super stardom with many hit albums, but it just didn't work that way. So that's a great question. It's one that, you know, people always look back on. What happened? How did this band that was so big in 1983 fall so far by the time it was 1986? So who knows? Maybe a heavier album would have been the right choice. We'll never know. But thanks, Mike. I thank you for the question. Well, what an episode. Thanks so much for Todd and Mojo for joining me on this one. And if you want to ask a question or have a comment talked about on the 80s Glam Metalcast, email me at 80sglammetal1@gmail.com. Coming up, the next episode is going to be with Rayan from the country band Early Ray. So the 80s Glam Metalcast is going country. It's going to be a good conversation. We'll see how it all ties into glam metal and hair metal. Talk to you next time. Rock on!